Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. COVID-19 has shut down most gatherings of more than 10 people, including funerals, forcing those left behind to manage a different kind of grieving process. The pandemic physically separates us, but that doesn't mean you must face the loss of a loved one or the pandemic stress alone. Becky Stumpfig is a licensed marriage and family therapist in California. She joins us. Welcome.
Thanks, Anne. Thanks so much for having me.
So how do funerals and gatherings of family and friends at the death of a loved one normally fit into the grieving process?
Well, funerals and family gatherings are really essential and such an important part of the grieving process. What we know about grief is that deaths really need to be marked. These are funerals and the way we gather together. They are essential tasks of our mourning process. Typically, leading up to the death, family members would be able to visit their loved ones in the hospital, hold their hands, tell stories about the loved ones. So not only is none of that able to happen right now, but also we're not able to gather and celebrate the person's life, which really is a huge part in allowing us to feel supported, recognize the loss, acknowledge the loss, and start accepting our new reality without that loved one in our physical world.
What's the sense about, what do we know about delayed grief? First of all, does that have to happen? I mean, is there a way to make up for this loss of rite of passage during this time?
Sure. That's a great question. Delayed grief does not have to happen. It's going to look very differently for families of that people, you know, have had loved ones who have passed away. It will look different in terms of their grieving process and the way in which they mourn, but it doesn't have to be delayed. Many funeral homes are offering live streaming services, so they're offering families the right to have graveside burials, and they'll allow perhaps the immediate family to attend those services while still following the social distancing guidelines. But then also they'll live stream that service so family and friends can join via live streaming. Many families are, and I encourage this, are holding virtual services, whether that be through Zoom or whatever online platform they're comfortable with. So many families are gathering virtually and talking about their loved one, essentially holding memorial services and celebrations of life virtually. So it looks very different and it feels very different and it's not the same as that personal connection. But people still can grieve in a different way than what we're accustomed to, so that it does not have to be delayed grief.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about the grieving process in the time of social distancing to prevent the spread of COVID-19. My guest is Becky Stumpfig. She is a licensed marriage and family therapist in California. If you have a question or comment, are you going through something like this right now? Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You know, it may not be family, but it could be friends or distant people, you know, that knew somebody and they want to express. You can still send flowers, you can still send cards, right?
Absolutely. And I really encourage people to find those connections. We're having to be very creative about the way in which we reach out to people who are grieving. Typically, you would have meals being delivered, homemade meals made for people, families gathering, attending church services. So none of those things can happen. But you're absolutely right that we can still reach out to people. We can send letters. We can call people. We can send texts. We can send emails. Many families have started to create Google documents that are shared amongst family members and friends, and that's a way that they can plan ahead of time for the service that they will eventually be able to have and get their ideas on that document for how they'd like to honor that person. So in some ways, it's actually giving families, instead of the rushed, pacing that normally occurs after a death in which you have to plan all of the services, which can be quite overwhelming, it's giving families more time to plan how they would like to truly honor their loved one.
I've heard a lot of people use the word grieving just to refer to our way of life and the loss of our way of life. And I'm wondering, I mean, for people who lose somebody like that, especially who lose somebody who they weren't able to be with at the end, is this manifesting differently?
I think it will. All of this inability to have funerals and memorial services and celebrations of life and not being with the person as they pass away, all of this is happening within the context of this overall collective grief that really the whole world is experiencing right now in the sense of we're grieving the loss of our independence and we're grieving the loss of our perhaps our financial security, our job, and our social contact with people. So people as a whole are experiencing a lot of grief right now. And then when you add on the loss of a loved one, it absolutely complicates that process for people. And many people are just feeling like they are so overwhelmed with the losses they're experiencing as a result of the quarantine and social distancing and stay-at-home orders that they're simply unable to really grieve the loss of their loved one right now on top of that. So it's a very different grieving process, than it would typically be had you just lost a loved one.
What are some things that you can, I mean, people are alone a lot now, even people who are home with family, they're just alone a lot more. What do you recommend they do with their time?
Yeah, that's a great question. There's a lot of isolation right now and a lot of, like you said, just a lot more time where we don't have our normal distractions of work and errands and school and all of the things we normally fill up our days with. So it is a lot more time at home. And we know when it comes to grieving specifically, grieving, one really effective way to work through it is in addition to connecting with other people, which, again, I really recommend, whether that's phone or emails or virtual gatherings, one really good method is through expressive arts, journaling. We know that grief needs to get out of the system. It needs to be expressed. It needs movement in order for us to work through it. So I really recommend that people spend time connecting with other people, however they feel most comfortable with, still keeping themselves safe. Doing some journaling if they're comfortable and if they enjoy doing art projects such as painting, drawing, that can be a really effective way of just getting those emotions out. And really for people that know somebody who is grieving, who has lost a loved one, whether it be corona-related or not, I really encourage those people to reach out to the people that are grieving. I think many times we hesitate to do that because we don't know what to say. We don't want to make their grief worse by bringing up mention of the person that has passed away, but that's exactly what they need. They need people to ask. They need to talk about their loved one that is no longer here. That helps them feel supported and work through their grief.
That's kind of a favorite thing to do, really, is to talk about somebody, and just even the most mundane things, it's fun to remember them. And in all the little ways.
Absolutely. It's a way of keeping that person really alive and honoring that person. And it's really one of the most respectful things we can do to support a person who is grieving. And people in grief will often say, you know, I don't know why they're not asking me about my loved one. Why are people avoiding me? And typically it really is because people don't know what to say. They don't want to cause more pain for that person, so they will avoid it. But what we know from research is that it really is so helpful to the person who is grieving to bring up their loved one and really give them the opportunity to share stories and really talk about their loved one. It can be so helpful and healing for people.
And, you know, the online obituaries now where you can add a comment, those are nice, no question about it. But there's also a little bit more time nowadays. It doesn't have to be a fancy card, just a piece of paper and an envelope with a stamp on it. I think getting something in the mail would be a lot more meaningful.
Absolutely. I think a lot of people are going back to kind of the, you know, classic methods of communicating, and a lot of people are embracing letter writing. I really encourage parents also who have kids, especially young kids, to encourage them to write letters to their loved ones, write letters to their grandparents. It has a very special way of cheering people up, and it can help us feel like we have a sense of control. So much of what people are experiencing right now, whether they're grieving or not, is anxiety from this feeling of helplessness, from not knowing what's going to happen. All of this has been very out of our control. So anything we can do to control our environment, control our own actions, writing a letter to somebody, expressing how much we care about them, that's a way that we have of controlling how we're handling this and doing something helpful for others, which can really help us feel like we are more in control of our world.
Sarah in Columbus, you're on the air with Becky Stumpfig, marriage and family therapist. Hi.
Hi there. I wanted to thank you for your comments about talking about your loved one that has been lost. I lost one of my brothers quite suddenly and unexpectedly in early February before the pandemic. And I was very fortunate to have interaction with clients and friends while I was in my shop and talk about him. And it did make it so much better, even in the short amount of time that it has been. And at the time, I observed that another sibling didn't have that kind of social interaction, and it was a bit more difficult for her.
Someone who was farther away, you mean?
Just more isolated at home.
Yeah.
Yeah. Whereas I had the social interactions of being even just in my business, but interacting with people and talking about my brother.
I remember losing a great friend, and every single night his mom and I would talk on the phone, and we would just talk about him over and over and over and over and over again. I never got tired of it, and I don't think she did either. Sarah, thanks for that call.
Yes, and I found that I laughed more than I cried.
Yeah, exactly. Sarah? I'm sorry, Becky Stumpfig?
Yes.
That sounds familiar. So we had that Sarah's experience having the interaction with people in a normal way, in the traditional way, and the idea here is not how to figure out how to make that up, at least for the time being.
Exactly. And I want to say thank you so much for sharing with us about your brother, and I'm so glad you did experience that support. And like you said, your sibling that did not, it can really change their someone's ability to work through their grief. When we hear other people reflecting on our loved one's life and when we are able to share stories and laugh more about them, it really helps us accept that loss a little bit more and just move us along a little bit further. And it just feels so comforting, as it sounds like Sarah experienced with her brother. So it is very important to our grief to be able to do that and to be able to feel that support.
Sarah, thanks for that call. I appreciate it. And for people who do have somebody in a nursing home right now who, or is in a hospital for whatever reason, COVID-19 related or not, what kind of recommendations do you give them for coping with that distancing at a time that it's just antithetical?
Yeah, it's a really hard and very heartbreaking situation. And I know the problem is very concerning in nursing homes specifically. There have been many illnesses and deaths, sadly, in nursing homes that are related to corona. So, it's a hard situation to deal with, but you can still write letters. I would definitely recommend writing letters. You can still have phone calls if your loved one is still in a, you know, a state where they can communicate on the phone. I would highly recommend both of those options. One aspect is also just sharing our gratitude for the medical workers, the doctors and nurses that work at nursing homes, because what's happening now is that because family members are not able to visit nursing homes, the medical staff has really become their extended family, and they are in the position where they are, you know, taking care of these people and showing them so much love and sitting by their side as they pass away and as they experience pain. And so they have, in a sense, become their extended family members. So I think for family members that have loved ones in nursing homes, just as best as you can, showing your gratitude and appreciation and really trying to communicate with the healthcare workers that are taking care of your loved ones can be very important.
Becky Stonefig, thank you so much for your time today. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me, Ann, and for covering this topic.
Becky Stonefig is a licensed marriage and family therapist in California. We've been talking about how to deal with grief in the time of COVID-19 and the social distancing. We have more Wellness Wednesday coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Toilet paper isn't the only hot commodity during this pandemic. Thermometers and the batteries used to power them are in high demand as well. That means a lot of people are using them, but not always correctly either. Dr. Donald Ford is a family medicine physician with the Cleveland Clinic. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
You cannot find a thermometer for love or money out there, no matter what kind you're looking for. I've sort of reverted back to the old-fashioned kind of thermometer, not with the mercury in it, but something that manifests as mercury. And I'm wondering what you recommend as the what thermometer works for who the best way.
You're absolutely right. The best way to take a temperature is an internal temperature, which means either oral or rectal. But the vast majority of devices that you can find, if you can find them these days, are going to be taking temperature from the skin or from the ear. Now, those aren't bad. They're certainly something that we can use, there's always a question of whether they agree with each other or not. And there's usually a very slight but measurable difference between measuring the temperature of the skin or the eardrum or taking an internal temperature.
So when you're measuring the skin or the ear, do you add or subtract, or do you regard the number differently?
It's so hard when we're trying to advise people using their devices at home. There are all sorts of factors that can affect what the skin temperature is, for instance, what the temperature is in the house, what the ambient temperature is, whether you just come inside from the cold. I've had the experience myself that they're checking our temperature every time we come into my office building, and they use an infrared forehead thermometer. And I've had readings as low as 95 or 96 degrees, and now I've just walked in from the cold. So I have to walk around a little bit and rub my forehead, and then it comes up to normal. So you just have to be aware of those factors when you're taking the temperature. One thing I would say is that regardless of the type of thermometer you're using, typically they're going to be consistent within themselves. So if you're taking a temperature over a period of time, over several days, you should notice that there's a consistency from one reading to another. And the time that we would get a little concerned about it is if it was definitely going up.
98.7 is supposed to be the normal temperature, but many people, including me, have lower temps. Around 97 is normal for me. I never get a temperature. And when I do, I mean, the rare times I have, then I know I'm really sick.
Right. And one of the things we found in the past few years is that the old reading, the old so-called normal temperature is not necessarily accurate. And what we should really be looking at is understanding that there's a range of normal temperatures. Now, it's not a huge range. It's anywhere from about 98.2 to about 99 degrees. Those would typically be normal. So if you fall in that range, some people's normal temperature would be on the lower side, some people on the upper side. But within that range, we still think that's a normal temperature.
Under 100.
Correct. The actual threshold we use for defining a fever is 100.4 or above. So there's a little bit of a gray area in there, and that's what we commonly call a low-grade temperature if you're somewhere between 99 and 100.4. It doesn't have the same clinical significance that over 100.4 does, which we definitely call a fever. And in these days, that's the time that I would think that it would be a good idea to alert your doctor.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher, and we're talking about how to take your temperature, what kind of devices to use. And my guest is Dr. Donald Ford. He's a family medicine physician at the Cleveland Clinic. If you have questions, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. How long have we been using thermometers? They've been around for a long time.
They've been around for centuries, but the modern thermometer really started in the middle of the 19th century.
The one that used to have mercury in it.
Correct.
And how does it work?
Well, mercury, to go back to the old ones, is a substance that's in a liquid form at normal temperatures, and liquids will expand or contract depending on the temperature. And the old-fashioned thermometer was a tube of glass with a thin channel for the mercury inside. If the temperature was warmer, the mercury would expand and move up that channel, so you'd see it higher on the scale that was etched into the glass. And if the temperature was lower, it would go down and have a lower reading on the glass. Now, everything these days is electronic. So there are all sorts of different technological means they have of measuring the temperature, direct contact with sensors, infrared, which is what I mentioned just a second ago. That's how we work our ear thermometers as well, as through an infrared ray that bounces against the eardrum and bounces back and gives a reading.
So when you push that button on the ear thermometer, that's what's happening?
Correct.
And then the sensors, those are the kind we typically get in the doctor's office, right?
Correct, yes.
And how long do you, what's the magic about how long you leave the thermometer in when you're dealing with a sensor?
Every device is a little bit different. The infrared is almost instantaneous. For some of the contact thermometers, you have to leave it on for, I would say, 30 seconds or so. Some of us of our generation may remember back to the old mercury thermometers, mm-hmm. and those you really had to leave in for a good minute or so for the mercury to stabilize in the thermometer.
And you need it under your tongue.
Correct. That's the most accurate. So that's why, you know, very few people these days, even in the hospital setting, do rectal temperatures just because it's invasive.
Uh-huh.
But getting it, if you're using a thermometer that goes in the mouth, it should go under the tongue because that's going to reflect your internal temperature.
Why do we get fevers?
Fevers are part of our immune system. And this is something that I think it's always important to help people understand. When you get an infection from a bacteria or from a virus, something from the outside, those infectious organisms are not actually causing our fever. The fever is propelled by our own immune system. When the body detects that there's some kind of pathogen, some kind of invasive organism in the body, it alerts all sorts of pieces of the immune system to send out white blood cells, to send out antibodies, and also to send out chemicals called cytokines that have the effect of raising our internal temperature. Now, nobody knows for sure, but we think that this is actually a defense mechanism because the vast majority of bacteria and viruses don't exist or don't reproduce as well at higher temperatures. So we're actually trying to get rid of the organisms by raising our internal temperature.
So how do you, so a lot of times though we take medicines to kill the, to reduce the fever. What's the tipping point there? Do we always want to be doing that, or do we just do it when it gets to be dangerous?
So you bring up a very good point that there's a balance that we want to strike between allowing the body's immune system to react, allowing these mechanisms to help us fight off the invading organism, and keeping ourselves healthy and comfortable. The risk of an uncontrolled fever is primarily dehydration. We tend to burn off a lot more fluid when we have a fever. You can observe it in the sweat. People tend to urinate more if they have an infection. So we're losing fluid, and that's also part of our body's way of getting rid of the invading organism. So it's good because we're doing that, but the risk is you get dehydrated. So you'll always hear doctors talking about push fluids, drink lots of fluids, and it doesn't matter what kind. It can be water, it can be cranberry juice, it can be sports drinks. Some of the things like Pedialyte, some of the electrolyte solutions, because of what's in them, they tend to absorb a little bit better than just plain water into the system, but they're not necessary. Water is fine. We're striking this balance between allowing our body to get rid of the organism and to keep enough fluid in it to keep us healthy. So when we have a fever, we feel lousy. I do recommend that people take some Tylenol or take some ibuprofen to help keep the fever down. And you'll notice, most people will notice that there's kind of a rhythm during the day when the fever seems to go up and when it seems to go down. So sometimes you can even anticipate those times. But basically, we're striking a balance between comfort and maintaining hydration and allowing our body to do its work.
Right. And then when a fever gets too high, what's it doing to the body?
Well, our bodies can tolerate very high temperatures. It's always alarming to parents of small children how high the temperature can go, because kids can get temperatures of 104, 105, something that really would be alarming in an adult, and they seem to be doing just fine. The risk in kids is not so much the number, not so how high the temperature goes. It's how fast it goes up.
Okay.
And that can create a risk for kids in terms of having something called a febrile seizure. It's very rare, but it is something to watch out for. For adults, we don't typically see temperatures quite that high, and our bodies seem to tolerate it well. Again, you know, the big point is hydration.
And that's kind of when you're talking, I just remember from when my son was an infant, we talk about spikes.
Correct.
Watch for the spikes. Why do we get fever? We get the chills, and then we get too hot, and we keep, you know, you go back and forth between chills and overheating with a fever.
Yeah. So the chills are really just a subjective adjustment as our body is releasing these chemicals that raise our temperature. It kind of starts from the inside out. So when you're starting a fever, you may experience that your outside feels cold, even though what's happening is that the internal temperature is rising.
Okay.
And that's what we experience subjectively as the chills. Once that raised body temperature gets all the way to the skin, we feel the heat, we feel sweaty, we get red in the face, and all those things, once it reaches the outside of our body.
Is there a protocol for cleaning and storing a thermometer? I guess it kind of depends on the type, right?
Well, yeah, and especially in something like the COVID-19 outbreak, you want to be very careful that you're cleaning your thermometers well, especially if you're going to use it on more than one person. We have a few in my house, and actually my daughter had returned from Africa and had to be quarantined, so I made sure that she had her own, and we kept it separate from the rest of the house. Alcohol wipes, hydrogen peroxide, bleach are all appropriate cleaning supplies, but you want to make sure as well that you're not leaving any residue of those in case it's in contact with the skin or with the mucous membranes.
And then we have an email from Mary. She said she plans to, well, I'm sorry, we had an email from someone else who has a mercury thermometer and they're not sure how to dispose of it. Do you have any ideas about that?
Yeah, mercury is a toxic element, which is why it's not used in manufacturing anymore for commercial thermometers. My best advice would be to call your local township or whoever disposes of your garbage and ask them, because they'll have protocols for getting rid of things like that.
And then we have an email from Mary. She plans to keep a card on her with her normal numbers, temperature, pulse, oxygen reading, and that kind of a thing. Is that a good idea, or is overthinking it, or what?
I think it's, frankly, I think it's a little overthinking it, because I'll go back to what I said, that the normal temperatures have a range. So if you say that your normal temperature is 98.3 and you come in with a temperature of 98.7, from a medical perspective, that's not necessarily significant. Now, 99 or 100 might be, but those small variations are not. I'd say the same thing about pulse as well. Pulse is a measure of our heart rate, which we measure in the sensation of pulsing in the wrist, typically. And it's completely normal to have one resting heart rate and another after you've been walking around, or certainly after you've been exercising. So all these measurements have ranges that can be considered normal. So I would think that having those normal ones on a card may be helpful, but I'm not sure that any medical professional would necessarily hang any treatment on that.
Is there a best time of the day to have take your temperature?
If you're measuring your temperature over several days, you want to do it at the same time of day.
Okay.
There is going to be a little bit of a difference. Typically, it's actually higher in the morning because your body's been resting. You've been under the covers. Everything is more relaxed. And after you've been up and around, we get a little bit less circulation peripherally. As you're standing, as you may go in and out of colder temperatures. So we see a little bit of daytime variation. So if you're trying to compare it from one time to another, take it at the same time of day.
So I'm taking it right before I come to work every day. So I've been up for an hour by then, and, you know, and it's pretty much the same, and it's always seems
it
low.
It should be fairly consistent, yeah.
Well, Dr. Donald Ford, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Well, stay well and stay afebrile.
Okay, Dr. Donald Ford, family medicine physician at the Cleveland Clinic. We've been talking about thermometers or how to take your temperature today. We have more Wellness Wednesday coming up, though, so stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Dan Fisher. The coronavirus pandemic dominates the news, but the opioid epidemic continues to take its toll. During the first 8 weeks of the year, Franklin County saw a nearly 50% increase over that same period last year in the number of overdose deaths. Andy Albrecht is the executive director at the Counseling Center, Inc. It's in Portsmouth, which serves Adams, Lawrence, and Scioto counties. Andy, welcome back to the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me back. Appreciate it.
And Dr. Myshika Roberts is the health commissioner for the Columbus Public Health Department. Welcome back, Dr. Roberts.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
What do you make of this spike or this increased number of overdoses over last year?
Well, it's obviously concerning, and any life lost is definitely an issue that we have to address. You know, in January of this year, the Columbus and Franklin County Addiction Plan rolled out our goals for the next 2 years, which is to make an impact on the number of deaths as well as the number of overdoses. So we've got lots of work to do, and it's obvious that you know, some of the efforts that have been made in our community over the last few years, we're not seeing the payoff or we're not seeing the positive impact of that work yet. But it takes time. You know, I liken it to the work we did with infant mortality. It takes time and momentum to really start seeing those numbers go in the right direction.
How much is the pandemic affecting that momentum, do you think?
Well, the pandemic is going to make a significant impact on all of our health issues that we're trying to work on, whether it's addiction or something else. As you can imagine, if you're living with the disease of addiction and now you are in a situation where you might not be employed, you might struggle to think about how you're going to pay for the roof over your head, as well as food on the table. And then in, on top of that, you're either in recovery from addiction or dealing with the disease of addiction. That can only exacerbate your anxiety, your stress, and can make you, could cause you to do things you wouldn't have normally done if it weren't for the pandemic, just because of that increased stress and anxiety.
Andy Albrecht, with the social distancing orders in place, how does that affect treatment for people who are struggling with recovery?
Well, I mean, from a recovery standpoint, I mean, it does. It's concerning, and it's, there's some barriers along with that. I mean, I know in Southern Ohio, of course, I'm here in Portsmouth, and we've been real blessed over the years to have a very robust recovery community, kind of outside of the counseling center itself, you know, in terms of 12-step recovery, like AA and NA, and along with that, there's a lot of social recovery functions that go along with that, you know, whether it's, you know, dances or softball games and all that sort of stuff. So we're real blessed with all that, but all that's kind of been put on hold right now. So, you know, if you are that individual that's in early recovery and you're used to having a network of recovery, whether it's activities or events that happen, especially right now in the, you know, the springtime, the weather's getting nice, and you know, it's just it's a time normally where that stuff starts to ramp up. It's caused some just concern and kind of limitations with all that right now.
I was thinking, Dr. Roberts, that with the social distancing, you know, it might be harder to get the drugs that you're seeking when you lapse, but that's not the case. There's still plenty out there, right?
Yeah, and, you know, unfortunately, I have to say I don't think that's the issue. I think what I get concerned more about with the social distancing, and if you're living with the disease of addiction, is you're likely spending more time alone than you normally would, and that could make you do, again, things that, you know, you might have put off or not done because you were, you know, had the support and comfort of others. And then the other thing is, if you do choose to use while you're in this social isolation period, you might not have anyone there as a bystander who can administer Narcan to you if you overdose. And, you know, when we look at the data, specifically in the last few weeks of overdoses, we've seen an increase in overdose deaths. But we haven't necessarily seen the same increase in overdose EMS runs or ER visits. And so these individuals who are using likely are using alone, and no one is there to provide Narcan or assistance if they do OD.
Have you seen an uptick like that without the corresponding increase in EMS runs, Andy Albrecht? Is that something you pay attention to?
Yeah, I mean, we pay close attention to that, and kind of similar feedback there. I mean, we have not really seen necessarily an uptick in that. Emergency room. We have an opiate response team at the counseling center, and we're the agency that gets kind of dispersed out to the emergency room when there's an emergency room or that EMS run or whatever. And actually, the last 3 weeks or so, it's been nothing unusual as far as looking at the trends and the data.
Dr. Roberts, I read that the latest trend appears to be mixing fentanyl with methamphetamine. What's the significance of that? Is that a supply issue? What do we know about why that is, and is it particularly more dangerous or not?
So, we've been saying this for a long time that no matter what your drug of choice is, you should have Narcan, because we know drug dealers are putting fentanyl in other substances and not just opiates.
Okay.
So I think it's just, in my professional opinion, it's the drug dealers trying to get a new group of clients and trying to realize that some people might be moving away from opiates and they're going to a new drug, and now it's meth, and so let's put something in the meth that will make them crave and want to come back for more. And that's part of the reason why we changed our name from the Columbus and Franklin County to the Columbus and Franklin County Addiction Plan, and took out opiates, because we knew we needed a plan that could evolve for whatever the drug of choice was for that point in time.
And Andy Albrecht, have you seen the same trend in Southern Ohio?
Oh, absolutely. That's probably the most concerning trend right now. And for example, our withdrawal management program, they were serving about almost 100% opiate-related cases really not that long ago. And the director of our program a couple weeks ago informed me, the methamphetamine admissions are way up, almost from zero up to, 20% or so. But at the same time, we've been through this before, mm-hmm. Back in the late 90s, early 2000s, when OxyContin was everywhere, and Southern Ohio had 11 pain pills that were, passing pills out like Skittles in Southern Ohio. When all those closed, which was a great thing that they closed, methamphetamine made a big comeback. There's always going to be that kind of void, and one balloon fills up with air and the other one releases, and then mm-hmm. the other balloon fills back up. And I think we're going through a little bit of that again. And we've seen that, about a decade ago. Now there's been, a tremendous amount of pressure on the state with, opiate related, cases, and these communities, it's been devastated. Well, you'll see a kind of a pivot, a transition back to methamphetamines. I think we're seeing it now, these little homemade meth labs are starting to pop back up again. And especially rural counties, rural areas.
Yeah.
So yes, we're definitely seeing that in Southern Iowa.
Well, how does that affect your approach to treatment, Andy?
Well, that's a great question. I mean, it complicates things. I mean, just when you get kind of a protocol down for, say, the opiate epidemic, mm-hmm. which might include kind of a variety of treatment approaches, whether it's, MAT and, medication-assisted treatment and sober living and all that. Now, all of a sudden, you've got a kind of new layer of issues on top of that, which is methamphetamine. That's a whole different, maybe detoxification and withdrawal and acute withdrawal symptoms. And so, I mean, it takes a very dynamic path. I think that's what we're finding out. I mean, it's not just opiates. It's everything. I mean, it's meth, it's opiates, it's alcohol, it's, cocaine, it's benzodiazepines. So, I mean, it takes a very dynamic staff, a very well-educated and trained staff of both, chemical dependency recovery professionals, but also medical professionals, to kind of sort through all of this.
Dr. Roberts, there's an article in front of me, and the headline is "Addiction is a Disease of Isolation, So Pandemic Puts Recovery at Risk." How can the public health system address a disease of isolation amid the rules and regulations that we're having to follow to fight the pandemic?
So it's a challenge. It's a challenge not just for Columbus Public Health, but, you know, any health department or any agency trying to respond to this disease of addiction during the pandemic, because we have to practice social distancing. Some of the work that we traditionally do in this area is challenging to do during a time of social distancing and avoiding mass gatherings. And so, you know, I commend our partners who are still out there. We're still trying to make sure that Narcan is available. There's a lot of information on social media for support and guidance. A lot of the counseling or support classes are not happening right now because you're bringing people together.
Right.
So trying to find innovative ways, can those be done by phone? Can you call in just when you need to talk to someone? When you can't have convening of large groups of people or even small groups of people at this point. So looking at innovative ways, I mean, one of the things we're doing is we're mailing people Narcan as opposed to having them come in to the health department or go into some other location. We're mailing them the Narcan with some instruction over the phone. So we're looking at different and novel ways to help this community during this pandemic. And some things that you might find are going to stick, we're going to continue to offer this even when some of this, the restrictions during the pandemic are lifted.
And what about you, Andy Ahlberg? How are you managing?
Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, you think about one of the major foundations of recovery, and what is that? It's social connectedness. So it's like, how well does someone get connected out in the recovery community and just in our community as a whole, you know, in early recovery and even maintaining recovery, you know, hopefully for years to come. So it's getting them ingrained and intertwined out in the community. Well, right now we're social distancing, right? So it's kind of like the exact opposite direction. So, you know, as the doctor mentioned, like we're doing a lot of the same stuff. I mean, you know, just kind of being creative, you know, whether it's social media and Facebook and, you know, telephone and texting and just kind of relentlessly following up on people and trying to get individuals, if they can, in front of a TV screen for, you know, telehealth check-in sessions. I mean, kind of literally doing whatever it takes to keep someone engaged in treatment. It's extremely challenging.
Let's see. Oh, I guess we lost our caller. Sorry about that. And as far as telemedicine and that kind of a thing goes, Dr. Roberts, that's okay if somebody has access to a computer or a phone and that kind of a thing. It's depends on the community you're talking about, right?
Absolutely. I mean, we find that many in our community do have access to a phone. It's the internet that's a challenge. So trying to get that, you know, the visual, the picture, the video that goes with the call can be challenging sometimes. But many of our clients just need that support. They need someone to lean on. They need someone to talk them through the difficult moment they're experiencing at that time.
Well, Dr. Mashika Roberts, I thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you. Thanks for having me, Ann. Take care. Stay healthy.
Yeah, you too. Dr. Mashika Roberts, Health Commissioner for Columbus Public Health, busy person. Also, Andy Ahlberg, Executive Director of the Counseling Center, Inc. in Portsmouth. Andy, thanks as always for your help. I always appreciate your contribution.
Thank you very much. Anytime.
And that's it for Wellness Wednesday today. Thank you so much for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.